Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
It might seem surprising that men imprisoned for their political beliefs and activities, men who lacked adequate food and clothing, men who suffered beatings at the hands of racist guards, should have concerned themselves with forming a soccer league. In a new book titled More Than Just a Game, authors Chuck Kaur and Marvin Close argue that the establishment of the Makana Football Association in the prison on Robben Island almost 50 years ago played a significant role in the successful fight against apartheid in South Africa. When I had the opportunity to speak with Chuck Kaur, I began by asking him how he'd become aware of the soccer league on Robben Island.
Well, serendipity plays an important role, I think, in the life of a historian. I was teaching at the University of the Western Cape in Cape Town in 93, and a friend of mine took me into what was called the archive. It actually was a warehouse where documents relating to Robben Island were stored until they figured out how to set up a museum and a proper archive. And he pointed to this collection of boxes, and they were labeled in pencil, Robben Island Sports. And what I discovered was, first of all, I got lucky. The first box I opened up contained hundreds of letters that the prisoners had written to one another. And a typical letter would be the secretary of the Rangers Football Club, Robben Island Prison, Robben Island, South Africa. And it was addressed to the secretary of the Makana Football Association, Robben Island Prison, Robben Island. My dear sir, it is with great regret that I must inform you that the quality of the refereeing is every bit as bad as it had always been. We would have won the match 3-0 had not the offside calls been made incorrectly. Yours in sports. And there are a couple of things that are strange about this. First of all, these are communal prisoners. They are showering together. They're breaking rocks together. They're being searched together. They're eating together. Why in God's name are they writing letters to one another? You know, why not just one day in the quarry tap somebody on the shoulder and say, the referee's lousy, we want another one next week? So part of it is, why write letters? And part of it is this overwhelming formality. And the next box I opened up had hundreds of match reports in triplicate. I had 3 days to look at these documents before I was heading home, and I went back 4 years later and started the research, because what I discovered and what was apparent is that these guys didn't play at football. I tracked down some of the men who created the league and ran it. One of them, the first man I interviewed, was by that time a senator in the new South African parliament. And I said, why didn't you just play? Why didn't you just have some fun? And he looked at me and he said, Chuck, you know that we were an English colony, and therefore you know that sports is too important just to be a game. He said, when we got the right to play football, the first thing we did was get some football. Second thing we did was blow them up. And the third thing we did was sit down and form our committees.
What was the daily life of a prisoner on Robben Island like before the establishment of the soccer league back in 1964?
Let me preface it by saying that when you mention Robben Island to virtually anybody outside of South Africa, the first thing and probably the only thing they know is this is the place where Nelson Mandela spent roughly the first 18 years of his imprisonment. I'm writing about the 95% of the prisoners who were not in the isolation section, who were not with Mandela and Walter Sisulu and Ahmed Kathrada. These are the men who were living in communal cells. They would be awakened sometime between 5 and 5:30 in the morning. They'd have to roll up their mats. Then they'd have to run out the front door of the cell and dig into a pile of shoes and sandals, because they were not allowed to wear their shoes or sandals in the cell block itself, because criminals sometimes would hide knives in their shoes. And for the most part, you would never get shoes that were the same size. You would occasionally get two left feet or two right feet. Then you would be lined up and you would run down a barbed wire enclosed path to the quarry. The average work day was from 6:30 in the morning to whenever sunset was. And Robben Island is about 5 miles off the coast of Cape Town. The sea breezes are always there. And for the first few years, they built the breakwater, they quarried the stone, and this might sound like a rerun of the Bridge on the River Kwai, but in this case it's reality. They built their own prison. When they arrived on the island in 1963 and 64, there was a ramshackle set of buildings. They built a first-class prison. And to this day, the men who worked on the prison are extremely proud of the quality of the prison. The deputy in charge of the quarry told the prisoners who arrived in 1964, "We are going to work you almost to death. What you will do is take very large stones and break those into large stones. You will break those into small stones, and you will break those into tiny stones, and you will spend the rest of your time here breaking stones." When they got to actually build something with the stones, it was gave them a degree of pleasure. They weren't just breaking stones for the sake of breaking them.
It's easy to understand that prisoners would crave an opportunity for recreation, but to what extent was the establishment of the soccer league on Robben Island a political act?
That's a wonderful question, because when you talk to the former prisoners, none of whom can imagine life on the island without football and without other sports, they will tell you that in many respects the most important thing was the battle to win the right to play in the first place. You have to understand, the political prisoners are very different from convicted criminals. These guys, first of all, are in prison because they were fighting for a cause. Everybody on Robben Island is male. Everybody on Robben Island is, in South African terms, non-white. And everybody is a political prisoner, even though that term doesn't exist in South African jurisprudence. They were political prisoners. And these are very savvy guys. And one of them got a hold of a copy of the prison regulations, which state that any prisoner who's incarcerated for more than 90 days has the right to recreation. There's also a right that any prisoner can, once a week, issue a written complaint about prison conditions. So the prisoners in the communal cells got together, and each week for 3.5 years, they would nominate 2 or 3 guys from each different cell to go make a formal written complaint that they want the right to play football, soccer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it would be turned down, and the ones who made the complaint would have their rations cut in half for the next week. That's why they had different people do it every week. And it took 3.5 years. And the chief warder said to his deputy, "It doesn't matter, because these guys are in such bad physical shape that they'll only play for a few weeks, and then they'll forget all this foolishness." Well, they started playing football in 1967. The second league was formed in 1969. The league ended in 1991 when the prison closed. Obviously, the chief warder didn't quite know the men he was dealing with.
After they had permission to build a soccer field and wear team uniforms instead of prison clothing, at least on the occasion of the games, what additional obstacles did the aspiring players face?
Well, part of it is just their physical condition, the bad food and hard work. But they ran a league that was unlike any other. For instance, every once in a while, a team would petition the league to reschedule their match because some of their best players had been sentenced to solitary confinement. There are 2 teams, for instance, that have to consolidate because they lost some of their best players. And this is your quintessential bad news, good news story. They lost some of their best players, which is the bad news. The reason they lost them is they had finished serving their term and they had just been released from prison. The best goalkeeper on the island, Sifo Shabalala, was released after serving 8 years, and he wrote a letter to his teammates in 1971, and he said how much it's been a pleasure to play with him, how much he's going to miss the circumstances in which they play. But in the future, when South Africa has success, and by success, he meant the end of apartheid and the creation of freedom, we will find our place amongst the giants of football. We will take our place amongst the best. Well, Sifo died a couple of years ago, but before he died, I was with him at the World Cup draw in 1997. So he knew that South Africa was going to host the World Cup. Uh-huh. And in 1998, FIFA, you know, the governing body of world soccer, recognized the Makana Football Association as the first ever honorary member of FIFA. And Sifo and 5 of the other founders of the league were there on Robben Island to accept the plaque and accept the membership in FIFA. It was a great day.
You maintain in More Than Just a Game that several of the political groups fighting apartheid disagreed amongst themselves about strategy and tactics in the struggle, and there were personality conflicts between them as well. To what extent did the Soccer League help the prisoners get beyond those disagreements?
That's actually a very simple question to deal with. There are two major groups on the island in 1964. There's the Pan-Africanist Congress and the ANC, the African National Congress. PAC is much the larger group amongst the first generation of prisoners. They cooperated in nothing other than their opposition to the authorities. They wouldn't share seminars. They wouldn't work in the same work gangs. They wouldn't do lessons together. There was no overt hostility, but there was nothing they would cooperate on. The first activity that the two political factions ever cooperated on was the creation of what became the Makana Football Association. So that shows just how important football was to them. But even then, they start off with a league of eight teams. There are four ANC teams, three PAC teams, and there's one team that has a provision written in its constitution that the Manang Football Club shall show no discrimination in the choosing of its members. Now, to most of us, discrimination means on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender. On Robben Island, discrimination meant political faction. Mm-hmm. Tony Souza, who's one of the men featured in the book, who was the top goal scorer on the island, and he's the one who wrote the constitution for Manang. And I said to Tony, is this really a good idea? You were breaking down barriers. And then I said, but there's another reason too, isn't there? And he kind of smiled at me. And I said, Tony, this gave you the option to recruit the best players regardless of political affiliation. And I got this wry grin from him, and he said, Chuck, I like to win.
This is the Branch Rickey theory of collecting players. Yes, you're doing something socially important and constructive. You're also more likely to build a winning team if you expand your player base.
Well, I'm going to talk to Tony in a couple of days, and he's a great fan of Jackie Robinson's. I will pass along your analogy to Branch. I described it to him in a different way. Somebody years ago described the missionaries who went to Hawaii, who went to do good and stayed to do well, and people like the Dole family.
What was the impact of the Soccer League on the guards and the relationship between the guards and the prisoners?
By the way, all the guards are white. I think it's fair to say 100% of them believe fervently in the righteousness of apartheid and also believe they were protecting the society from communist, anarchist, savage rebels. They began to see the prisoners as something more than subhuman. But most of all, the guards got wrapped up in the same way the prisoners did, just in the spectacle of watching football being played every week. There are some stories about guards betting on the games amongst themselves. One of the guards in the quarry was famous for approaching prisoners and trying to get inside information as to who was hurt the next week and who might be playing. In other words, what happened amongst the guards and the prisoners is symptomatic of the most important reason I think football changed the lives of the prisoners. And this might sound terribly ordinary to you. Football was a way in which the prisoners could reconnect with the ordinary, mundane reality of everyday life outside the prison. One guy described it best. He said, from Saturday afternoon to Wednesday afternoon, everybody would talk about last week's match. And from Wednesday afternoon, when the fixture list, the schedule, came out, from Wednesday afternoon to Saturday morning, everybody would be talking about next week's match. Well, that's exactly what would be happening if they were living in Pretoria or Johannesburg or Cape Town. For a few hours in any given week, you could almost, and I emphasize almost, forget you were on Robben Island and begin to think that that you were someplace else. In the same way, they had interminable committee meetings. I mean, they met to discuss everything. And I asked the secretary of the Makana, why did you have so many committee meetings? Said, Chuck, what's the one thing you have the most of in prison? And I said, time. He said, well, would you rather spend time thinking about your family back home, or would you rather spend it in a boring committee meeting?
You write that the Makana Football Association faced its greatest challenge in the mid-70s when a group of young prisoners arrived on Robben Island with a very different mindset from some of the prisoners who were already there. What was the nature of that challenge?
The so-called Soweto generation, the ones who came to prison after Soweto uprisings in 1976, they were much younger. Most of them were school kids who went out with rocks in their bare hands and tried to take on the authorities who had automatic weapons and tanks. They came to the island, and their immediate reaction was, we're not going to cooperate with any of the guards. We're going to cause as much trouble as we can. And by the way, the men who have been serving on the island for the last 12 or 13 years must have sold out to the authorities. How could they have dreamt of building the prison? Why are they so proud of having built a prison? And for God's sake, they're getting to play soccer. Well, that means they must have given up something. They were taught by the older generation that the first goal of a political prisoner is to survive. The second goal is to maintain your dedication to the struggle. That means taking classes. That means having discussions. It means doing something that keeps you mentally and physically alert. And if that means not constantly bickering with the guards, then that's a compromise that's well worth making. And in a funny way, remember, these are youngsters, the Soweto generation. It was a lot easier to convince them to do that when the result of it would be to do something they wanted to do anyhow, which was play football. Underlying this whole thing is the theme that Marvin and I think, and the former prisoners themselves, think makes the book different and makes it important. It's a story built around soccer, but it's not a story about soccer. It's a story about dignity, and it's a story about striving for political goals. It's most of all, I would say, it's a story about using soccer as a way not to give up, not to allow the authorities to tell you who you are. Soccer gave them a mechanism by which they could remind themselves of their essential dignity and their essential personhood.
Chuck Kaur is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and the co-author of More Than Just a Game, published by St. Martin's Press. He joined me from KWMU in St. Louis. Chuck, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's been fun.
My conversation with Chuck Kaur, the co-author of More Than Just a Game, Soccer versus Apartheid, the most important soccer story ever told, will be featured on this week's program. We'll also be looking back at what's been happening in the NBA and NHL playoffs and speculating a bit on what's likely to happen next, including the future of LeBron James, currently still of the Cleveland Cavaliers. We'll have the story of a man who makes his living at the racetrack not by betting, but by picking up litter. That is, collecting the winning tickets other bettors have tossed away by mistake. And we'll discover what one former pro basketball player is doing to build a more sustainable future through farming. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.